The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 1. Close to Happiness. It was ridiculous. It was raining a lot, Harry's hands were cold, and the place Sirius wanted to take them didn't look like it was particularly well insulated. When he said he had a better option, Draco jumped at it. Now that Harry was in the company of two adult wizards he could practice magic freely, he only had to find a place with no muggles and he could conjure up a house, just as he had been doing on his trip here. There was an empty plot on a side street, in between two buildings with no windows looking to the empty space. No one was out in the rain. It was perfect. It was, however, extremely awkward. It was so awkward that he danced through the whole full song and didn't get anything to happen. He tried to do it with his eyes closed and start with his back turned to them so he wouldn't feel embarrassed, but he still fainted. Sirius looked as if he were quite entertained nonetheless. He grinned and gave Harry two thumbs up. From time to time he shook himself like a dog to get the worst of the rain out of his hair. This time Harry asked them to please turn around, which they did with just a little bit of grumbling because someone didn't want to let Harry out of his sight. They absolutely balked at the idea of walking to the ends of the short streets to see if anyone was coming, so turning around was it. But it worked. There was a house. He even got two bedrooms.
"So, did you all hear a song?"
asked Sirius Black, still turned.
"Because I heard a song. At first he was singing by himself, but by the end, I heard the voices and instruments."
"It's the earphones," Draco pointed to his own ears. "They don't always work with him, and the music falls out. Happens all the time."
"Ah, I see."
They turned around.
"The house is new, though," pointed Draco,
expert commentator on current Harry behavior.
"I found the lack of yellow underwhelming," said Sirius.
"So, how are you getting food?" asked Remus.
The four of them were now sitting at a table in the house. All coats and wet shoes had been left in a corner. Harry shrugged.
"It comes with the house."
"That's not possible," Draco said slowly. "You never knew with Harry."
"Why not?"
"Why not?" exclaimed Sirius, the charms nerd. "What have you been doing in Hogwarts? It's the very first exception to Gamp's law of elemental transfiguration. You can't conjure food out of thin air."
Thump. Boing. The toaster chose that moment to violently expel two slices of toast with such force that one of them flew out of the crib and fell onto the kitchen counter.
"I didn't know that," said Harry. "To be honest, I did not pay any attention in class."
"I can confirm that," Draco peeped.
"So this is what you've been eating?" asked Remus, who was now examining the kitchen and opening a few cabinets. With his height, he did not have to stand on tiptoe to see the contents of the highest shelves.
"Toasted and cheese and other snacks," he had a tone. Not a tone of wonder, precisely, at Harry's dismissal of Gum's first explanation or whatever it was. It was the parental tone that children around the world know means it's time to come up with good excuses and some adamant denial.
"Pretty much, yes."
"And what about vegetables, young man?"
Oh, someone was in trouble. Remus had a hand on his hip.
"Have you eaten any fruit at all?"
Harry argued that he did not actually choose what kind of food appeared and that at some point there had been a stew with peppers in it, which totally counted as vegetables. None of this served him as an excuse, and Remus lectured him on the importance of vitamins and eating fruit and green vegetables, and of course honey didn't count as one, even if it came from flowers. By the end of the lecture, the house produced some spinach and a bunch of bananas out of embarrassment. Everyone, including Sirius, went hurriedly to eat one under Remus's vigilant eye. The rain and wind picked up as the evening blended into the night. There is nothing quite like listening to heavy rain while you are inside a house. If you can touch something made of wood at the same time, a table or the floor or anything, the place instantly becomes 10 times better. Harry noticed out of the corner of his eye that Draco's shoulder started to go down from his ears, and Sirius's face changed softly as if he only now were allowing himself to feel tired. The house, the biggest Harry had been able to conjure so far, had two bedrooms in addition to the open kitchen and living room and bathroom. Perhaps someone would expect them to have the grown-ups in a room and Draco and him in another, but although Harry liked Draco, he was just Draco, the snotty schoolmate. Across was his dad, whom Harry had missed madly for the last 5 years. Harry would say that his sleep had improved considerably from that horrible first year of school. However, that night was the first night he really slept. Harry fell asleep snuggled in Remus's arms, feeling safe and warm and loved, like he had felt and barely remembered after watching Sleeping Beauty for the first time. He slept and he felt rested. However, in his quest to get his childhood back, Harry had grown. He would not get back those missing years and all those hugs he didn't receive. He was happy now, and for the whole duration of that evening and night, his mind and body told him that he could relax, that it was good, that all would be well. But Harry had grown. With adulthood comes the realization that parents can't fix all, that there are dangers that are too big. Harry had grown, and he had faced more challenges than most. Before falling asleep, he talked and talked to Remus, tried to tell him about everything that had happened. And without meaning to, he found himself editing things. This is what you do when you return after a long absence. You don't speak of certain things because you know they bring pain. Remus noticed, because some days Remus almost seemed clairvoyant. He wasn't. He just knew Harry very well. He let Harry talk, and when he was done, he very carefully asked the questions, and Harry spoke. Dumbledore and Harry's feelings of disconnection in the face of his obvious kindness and Harry's guilt over it. The Dursleys. Oh, the Dursleys every bloody year. Umbridge and her torture. This one was hard, because Harry knew Severus couldn't do anything about it, so he had to keep it hidden from him to avoid hurting him. Harry told him all of that, incapable of looking him in the eye and taking refuge in Remus's arms. There is something about being hurt that makes you feel ashamed when you should be proud that you survived. And there was something he didn't speak of, something Harry couldn't utter and make into words. There was a new scar on his chest. Angry purple lines that were slowly turning to pink and silver. Harry felt like something had been removed from him when he got that scar, and he was afraid. Afraid that he couldn't die, and that every encounter with Voldemort, with death, would take a little bit of him until he became a monster like Voldemort himself. Really, how can you give voice to a thought like that? The house started to waver and collapse an hour after breakfast the next day. Harry managed to keep it up, but the moment he stepped outside, the whole thing disappeared, leaving behind a small cloud of dust.
"We need something a bit more permanent," pointed out Sirius sagely. He was grinning. The man seemed unable to be inconvenienced by any obstacles.
Sirius and Remus, the adult supervision in charge, had an incredibly long and boring conversation about where to go next. Harry tuned out after just a minute, which was the time it took Sirius to go from cool uncle to adult neurotically worried about safety. It was Remus's default mode. In Sirius, it was more of a surprise. Harry didn't know exactly where they had been hiding all this time after their escape, but apparently they both agreed emphatically it was not an adequate place for young adults or long stays. Draco had an equally bored and disengaged expression, like he would gladly accept living under a bridge if only they would shut up right now.
"How's Hogwarts?" asked Harry. What a careful question that was. No, why are you here, or what happened?
Draco explained. The riots and Umbridge and all the things they conjured and how they fought. Everything except for why exactly he had left.
"So did you just walk out the main gate?"
Harry was confused and a bit angry with himself. "Because I think I tried that my first year, and it was locked." Main door of the castle, not locked. Door to the land outside, probably locked. Draco didn't know because he'd just started to walk blindly through the forest. Harry was fascinated by his description of Mercilius. Harry and Draco had been enemies, and then reluctant allies, and then silent friends. Today they started to become brothers, perhaps, or maybe something else.
"A poltergeist is hardly a dark lord," Sirius was saying. "And it would keep death ears away."
The second most haunted house in the United Kingdom. That's where they agreed to go. Unlike the Shrieking Shack, Britain's most haunted house, this one seems to actually have some spirits living in there. Sirius reasoned that it provided perfect cover, and Remus somehow agreed with him. The house was just a day of travel away, a morning if they took the train, between Birmingham and Northampton. It was missing half of the roof, and the garden was infested with the gnomes.
"They came here before us. I don't think we should say infested," Remus argued.
The house itself, however, was free of doxies, boggarts, and other pests. probably because of the very real malevolent spirit living there whose presence could be felt as soon as they crossed the garden fence.
"Cooey!"
said Sirius, shoving his head through an open window. The window pane swung close and would have slammed him in the face had it not been for Remus's quick arm. Harry and Draco stood aside and watched the old marauders work their magic as they entered the house and charmed the resident spirit. Not actual charms, as in spells, but their irresistible and delightful allure that had bewitched more than one professor into forgiving their transgressions.
"James was a natural at this,"
Sirius told them later while they examined the rooms. Other than the second floor and its open roof, the rest seemed to be in quite a decent state.
"He was the first one to befriend and name Sirius."
Draco glanced aside at Harry, the boy who had petted Dragon. "You don't say." And just like that, they moved in. The moon came just a few days after their arrival at the house. That was the main reason why Sirius and Remus had agreed so quickly to the haunted house. There was enough to rain for the wolf to run, and Sirius would make sure he didn't hurt anything bigger than a rabbit. It was a very emotional evening. First, Remus went into a weird mood in which he lectured them tirelessly on safety measures and demanded that they barricade the door with the console once he and Sirius left the house. Then Harry became all anguished because Remus obviously wasn't taking the wolfsbane, nor had he for the last few years. The potion took days to brew and had to be taken for a week, so of course he couldn't be taking it, and black market potions were dangerous. But still, Harry got incredibly upset. And that's when Draco realized.
"That bastard!"
he said. Draco had excellent manners, probably the only positive trait he had gotten from his parents. Everybody went silent and turned around to look at him at this expletive.
"That two-faced liar!"
Draco was... well, he was astonished. He had to sit down.
He was helping you! Father said he was a Death Eater too and that I was to trust him, but he was helping you!"
"What are you talking about?"
asked Harry and Sirius at the same time.
"Draco, are you all right?"
Remus was smiling faintly. He liked Draco's explosions of emotion. He liked them a lot. The kid was so tightly wound.
"Oh, don't you all right me, don't you dare!"
Draco exclaimed, dragging his syllables.
"You know what I'm talking about!"
Severus freaking Snape, professor of potions, head of house, Death Eater. But apparently not so much the last one. Not the bootlicker for Dumbledore, either. Draco had been raised in the belief that Dumbledore and the Ministry were fools and easy to deceive. Lying to the Dark Lord was a harder feat. Keeping a secret from a Malfoy was a foolish and ultimately hopeless act. Gosh, he felt so proud of Slytherin right now. Best head of house ever. The moon was still coming. They didn't attempt to deny it because it was so clear now. Who else had the knowledge and means to brew the potion for so many years? Who else could do that and cover his traces so well that the Ministry wouldn't suspect a thing?
Exactly.
Sirius and Remus left, both of them chuckling at Draco's wit and indignation at Snape's deception. Sirius hadn't figured it out. He and Harry cleaned the after-dinner dishes. They were going to spend the night together in the cellar, kind of like a sleepover in a way. They had brought the bedding down, and the only door to the stairs could be easily barred. Remus was not running any risks. Even if he could shake Sirius away and made his way back to the house, he would never get to the boys. Never. They went down calmly, as if it were a habitual thing and nothing out of the ordinary. And they talked. Perhaps this was the first time they were just by themselves, so it was quite fortunate, really, that Draco had his realization then, because they had a wonderful topic to chat about. Draco couldn't believe the enormous prank Snape was pulling on everyone. Harry referred to him as Severus for Merlin's sake. And Harry was also quite shocked to discover that Severus had been giving Draco treats and support since his third year. Not that Draco didn't speak of it, but not that anything had been as bad as the summer before his third year. Draco had learned very well how to act so that it wouldn't happen again, but nevertheless, Snape had always been there to provide the right excuses. Ridiculously long extra credit assignments with lots of busy work that would keep Draco occupied and out of his father's sight during holiday breaks. He didn't even have to complete them just to say that he was doing so. Advanced potions projects that let him come to the classroom and brew something and be alone with his thoughts for a while. The occasional chocolate wand. Draco wondered if there had been more and he didn't see it. Now that he thought about it, Snape had been awfully unhelpful with Umbridge. Remus always needed his sleep after a transformation, doubly so when he had no potion. Sirius decided to take the boys out and let Remus sleep the morning away. They needed to buy some groceries anyway. Harry's ability to produce food was limited. What wasn't required was for Sirius to drop an arm over each of the boys' shoulders and say, "All right, lads. Time someone gives you a proper education." He ignored the shared look of embarrassment and secret delight because neither of them had known such a cool uncle, and started a 2-hour-long monologue on fashion. At least 45 minutes were dedicated to socks. To Harry's horror, not only did Sirius have strong and varied opinions about socks, but so too did Draco. Harry's socks were brown, left, and pink, right. He kept putting his hands in his pockets and pushing down so the hem would cover his ankles because the passion in the argument told him he may not make it back to the house alive. The aura of sophistication, however, cracked irreparably once they were at the shops, and Harry realized that neither of them had the faintest idea of how to cook. Sirius actually thought that a package of flour per meal was an adequate proportion. Draco stared at the pasta and did not say anything, but Harry was pretty sure he had always thought it was sold in soft form. He took care of the shopping, careful to include enough fruit and vegetables to keep Remus happy. On the way back, Sirius told them stories of his family, of all the magical families, and of Hogwarts. Sirius had moved in with Harry's father when he was 16. Harry thought he might have known that, but Remus hardly spoke of Sirius back then. Remus woke past noon and walked into a warm kitchen full of food and giggling teenagers. Harry hugged him and passed him a freshly made cup of chamomile tea. "Sirius was telling us about the year with Professor Norrington." "Whatever he says, he is exaggerating," Remus said smoothly as he claimed a chair for himself, "except for the bit about McGonagall." This elicited a new round of shrieks and guffaws. Draco put both hands over his mouth and went red. Remus felt a pang of pain at seeing him instinctively cover up his laughter. "Perhaps Sirius has forgotten that he too is affected by the confundus caught in DADA class," Remus added after taking a sip of his tea. Sirius said something to the effect that Remus was the one with the faulty memory and wasn't he tired anyway? Shut up, Mooney. Remus ignored him and turned to the boys. The smile on Harry's face was perfectly wicked and all of James. Draco was still covering his mouth, his eyes wide open in delighted horror. "So rather than asking out Augustina Pinkerton to the ball," Remus explained. "Oh my God, I can't hear this, it's too much. He got sidetracked and somehow made his invitation to Professor McGonagall." The boys laughed so hard Harry stopped breathing for a few seconds. Draco had tears in his eyes.
"Is all this necessary, Mooney?"
"I haven't even told them yet that it happened at lunch in the Great Hall."
Remus was a very good storyteller. Better after so many years listening to Severus's masterful accounts. He knew just when to pause to let the audience laugh before continuing the story.
"She was quite gentle in her rejection, I believe. What were her words exactly?"
"Black, I'm afraid you are the fourth gentleman to make such an offer today," Sirius sighed, reminiscing. "I offered to fight them, too. Said I would lay their wands at her feet. I put Avery Jr. in a headlock."
More than 15 years and the presence of Gilderoy Lockhart were necessary before Hogwarts saw any kind of romantic festivity again, all because of a clumsy DADA teacher, some misdirected confundus spells, and Minerva McGonagall receiving over 12 invitations that year from the student body. Dumbledore received none, but Flitwick had 3, all from Slytherin students.
"Minerva was a stunner,"
added Sirius, and after both Harry and Draco raised their brows, he went on,
"Not when we were there. She had already aged then. But at some point, she was absolutely gorgeous."
It was hard, supposedly. It was cold and wet, and Draco didn't know very well how exactly they were getting money, only that he had been told not to worry. The spirit had accepted them, but still there were days when doors slammed and books flew, and you would find all the chairs stuck to the ceiling. Or you would be in bed about to fall asleep, and you would feel a rustle and something cold and wet touching the back of your neck. In that case, Sirius said you could come to his room, and he would transform into a dog, and then you could sleep there. Even if the spirit tried it again, the dog would growl and send it away, and you could fall asleep warm and safe, and with your face buried in the black fur. They invented a game called Harry or Ghost. The game consisted of noticing that a particular piece of furniture had moved or something had changed color, and then wondering whether it was due to Harry or the resident ghost. You didn't win anything for guessing right, but occasionally the poltergeist could be heard laughing. And Draco. Draco had no idea, all right? No idea. He wondered if this was how the Weasley clan lived. It probably was, and it explained why they didn't seem to mind very much their pauper state.
It was a life of ugly decor and old clothes and a bit of hard bread and laughter, so much laughter. Like walking into a room to discover the renowned and feared werewolf Remus Lupin standing on a chair and carefully putting Sirius's toiletries on top of the ceiling lamp because the game Harry or Ghost accepted secret third players. Draco's silent complicity was bought with a chocolate bar. Like running around the garden throwing a ball with Harry and it transformed Sirius. Sirius cheated. He would tackle you to the ground or feint at your ankles so he could get the ball. Like walking with Harry through the garden and to the meadow and forest beside, the grass knee-high at some points. Harry, who hadn't questioned his presence at all, and who was carrying a plastic bag, and had given Draco another so they could gather some magical plants. Draco outgrew his clothes, and the ones they managed to find him were second-hand and ugly, and of course he realized the irony. But he couldn't dedicate it much time, because never in his life had he been so close to happiness. Harry slept well, soundly and completely dead to the world, often with an arm hanging out of the bed. Remus liked checking on the boys in the mornings, still 2 or 3 hours before they began to stir. There is no sleep as long and deep as that of a teenager. A child will sleep well, but the teenager is something else. More often than not, Remus found that Harry had conjured something in his sleep. The sheets or the windows were another color, and a couple of times he found 3 butterflies of colored smoke circling the bed. They vanished as soon as Harry woke up. It turned out that Draco, while naturally fair-skinned, was not supposed to have that unhealthy pallor. The red marks faded away, and they took with them the shadows under his eyes. He ate everything they put before him with gusto, and what's more important, he kept it down. Draco hadn't gone hungry a day in his life, but there had been a time, or the last 3 years really, when his stomach rebelled and he could barely hold anything down, and he told himself it was nerves about Quidditch and the stress of the exams. Severus would brew him something that helped. It was quite a thing, this little bubble of peace they had carved out in the world. Remus could hardly risk revealing their location or exposing Severus by addressing him directly, but he still sent him a coded message. He could not say how much, limited by space and fears of the message being intercepted, and he could not say anything explicit or too revealing. But it was important to tell him this. He bit the end of his pen, because they used pens rather than quills in the house, as he thought. He could hardly dedicate more than 2 lines to any of them. "The curtains change color 3 times a day, he wrote. "Evenings are pink and orange, nights are purple." This should be enough to tell Severus that Harry was fine, that he was being cared for, and he was happy. It wasn't enough, but it would have to be. Remus would like to tell him about the guessing games with the moving furniture, about Harry playing badminton with the poltergeist, about hearing music when Harry was dreaming. But Severus would know all of that anyway. Harry was back to changing colors around him, and Severus could guess the things in between. "The other child is fattening and getting a bit of a tan. He laughs a lot, and wears a big old sweater and hasn't complained once." It really was a dreadfully ugly sweater. Remus felt bad for making Draco wear it, but he really needed better clothes than what he had come with, and it was the only suitable piece they found. Sirius had brought some more things later, but Draco clung to the ugly sweater, saying it was actually quite soft, and Remus guessed he found comfort in oversized clothes. Summer would be upon them soon, yet Draco still wore the light sweater and Sirius's leather jacket. "The shadows..." Remus hesitated here. Should he really write of Sirius to Severus? But then again, what would he think if he did not? Severus would probably get the wrong impression either way, so Remus would share this too. "The shadows have receded. There is healing for both, but my friend benefits more from the company."
"We have to protect those 2 boys at all costs."
Remus looked up from the bed where he was folding laundry. Sirius had abandoned the sock-pairing duty to stare down the window. "Of course," Remus said. He used a soft and calm tone, because with Sirius you never knew. He was doing so much better now. He was upbeat and energetic and happy. But he was still paying the toll of Azkaban. Remus dropped the shirt he had in his hands and went to the window. Sirius's eyes were wet. "Sirius." Remus rested a hand on his back. He didn't know what to say to erase that look of distress. He wasn't sure there was anything he could say.
"You did well, sniping you,"
Sirius continued. He sniffled.
Yes?
Remus figured that this was a strong wave of emotions, but not exactly anxious apprehension or some of those dreadful waking nightmares that sometimes assaulted both of them, but particularly Sirius. Sometimes Sirius spoke so much because he was genuinely happy and overjoyed at being able to feel anything again. And sometimes he did because the sound of his voice drowned the dreadful memory of the silence of Azkaban. Remus looked through the window, to the scene that had so captured Sirius's attention. The boys were there, sitting in the overgrown garden with its gnome colony. Harry was chatting animatedly about something. Remus couldn't make out the words from that distance, just the scrunch of his face, so much like Lily's, and the hands moving. Draco was kneeling behind him, absorbed in his task of braiding Harry's hair. Not a simple plait, even, but a careful arrangement of multiple small braids with flowers intertwined.
"Let them not be touched by war," Sirius whispered, pleading.
Remus was reminded of a summer day almost 11 years ago, when Severus had said something similar, had said that Harry had fought and paid enough. Remus had a similar wish. Let them make it to the other side. War and darkness would eventually reach them, but please, let them survive that with their light intact. There was dinner consisting of roasted vegetables with less grated cheese sprinkled on top than everyone would have liked. The asparagus, however, were pretty good. There was a certain reluctance to admit it at first, because it was understood that it was better not to encourage Remus. However, Harry informed them that it was in fact very important to find something with vegetables on it and praise it to the heavens. Otherwise, Remus would keep trying to feed them variations, and he would rather not have to eat broccoli, thank you very much. Remus would see them eat greens, that was a fact of life, so they should just accept it and find something tasty. It was nice. They actually liked them. Then Harry got into a thinking mood. The hints were very subtle. Only Ron could tell accurately when he was doing it, chasing a thought down a spiraling slope to its ultimate, usually hilarious consequences. Like the time Harry remarked that out of the Weasley children, Percy had by far the curliest hair, and 5 minutes declared that Percy was too tall anyway, tall for what? And he was sure that if he had hairy feet, the twins would have already informed him. It was just the kind of trivia they wouldn't lose an opportunity to share. But Ron wasn't there to warn them. Not that he would have, this was something he enjoyed by himself. Harry put the fork down and looked at Remus.
"You're 36.
"Yes, Harry. "You're an adult, like, responsible, supervising."
"Should I be offended that I'm not being included?" asked Sirius, honestly curious.
He wasn't sure if he wanted to be considered responsible.
"But, oh my God, but..."
Harry made a pause to get his words in order.
"You got me when I was 3.
"A few months before, yes."
"You were 23. You were 7 years older than I am. You were younger than Billy Weasley is now, and he wants you to bog on a dare."
Everybody was staring at Remus now, as if it were somehow his fault that he had been so young.
"You were the same age as Charlie the Dragon Whisperer."
"That's only 2 years older than Marcus Flint," added Draco. "He had to stay in Hogwarts an extra year because he failed his newts."
Harry needed a minute to process this realization and wonder how he had survived, because, wow, that was not an age to be taking care of anyone. He couldn't get out of his head the image of Charlie Weasley and Marcus Flint taking care of a baby.
"I will admit that we were young and inexperienced and had absolutely no idea what to do," said Remus in his usual calm tone. "But we knew not to use Evanesca to clean you, and we only dropped you on your head twice."
"That didn't happen.
I always worried about your penchant for eating spiders, but you didn't seem to get sick, so I let you do it."
"That didn't happen!"
Remus had had to mature quickly. First when he was bitten, and then when he became a father. Besides, he was naturally careful and responsible and neat. He was the man who remembered about having a balanced diet and washing your teeth before bed and sorting your clothes for laundry. This didn't mean he did not possess a devious sense of humor. What little mischievous streak Harry hadn't inherited from James, and he had got plenty, he had learned from Remus. Severus taught him how to get away with it.
"And there was a time when you were 5, when you pretended to be a flamingo for a whole month."
"That didn't happen!"
"Please say it didn't, tell me more,"
begged Draco. Harry taught Draco how to play football.
They made the goals in the garden with the internationally approved goal marks. That is, backpack, jacket, tree, group of stones. They were both equally bad, and the grass was too tall to be able to kick anything, but they still had fun. At some points, the gnomes got tired of them running around through their lands and trying to take their ball, and there was a quick conversation with both boys laying face down on the ground, inches away from the gnomes, which every book said you shouldn't do because what if they bit you in the face? And soon they were playing a game of football, tallies against shorties. Draco braided Harry's hair a few more times. He put flowers in the dark locks and thought that with his green eyes, Harry looked like a creature. Like the animal familiar temporarily turned into a human that Sirius and Draco had impersonated. Harry said his Patronus was a stag. Draco thought he did look like a fawn. Somehow Sirius heard and started referring to them exclusively like that. Fawn and swan. Dinners were never a boring affair in that house.
I was an accident, wasn't I?
Sometimes Harry was the worst, the absolute worst. Remus was prepared for it. Remus had been there, suffering through all of it. He was inured to all sort of awkward comments and questioning, although he was starting to suspect there was something in ice cream composition that triggered the worst of it. Draco, too, had developed some sort of resistance to Harry saying weird things. He was there the time Harry stole the kittens they were supposed to work with in Transfiguration, and brazenly told McGonagall he had no idea what she was talking about, even though everyone could see the kittens moving under his jumper, because of course Harry had forgotten to put on proper robes. Sirius, however, didn't have the benefit of training, so of course he choked on his water, which may have been Harry's purpose for all they knew.
I mean, my parents had me when they were, what, 20? In the middle of a war, too. You can't tell me they planned for that.
Remus kicked Sirius under the table. It was for his own good. These things, it was better to wait them out in silence.
And yet they're like 20 of us in our year, said Draco with a considering look.
Trot to Slytherin, and Draco in particular, to contemplate all the ramifications. Harry was nodding his head.
Right, children of Death Eaters, I can understand, but for the others. And they called us irresponsible and the Prophet during the riots,
Draco was indignant.
We didn't get up to any hanky-panky.
Pansy would murder you.
Snipe would murder us. You have no idea. No, I know you have your secret chats, but you have no idea how he is as a head of house.
The conversation veered in that direction, and whose head of house was worst, and how the Ravenclaws had it the easiest, because Flitwick was a beautiful cupcake. Harry was still disappointed that he missed the common rooms tour. Sirius regained his breath. He had a smile, too. James was never so prone to non-sequiturs, but he did blurt his thoughts in a similar manner. Most famously, the time he stopped a Newt-level DADA lecture to ask why exactly was the professor so sure of the description of a Dementor's mouth. Had anyone checked recently? Because it seemed to James as if someone had made it up and every book had been blindly repeating it. For all they knew, Dementors looked like an angry alpaca under their hoods, and it was worth exploring. Lily had been as red as her hair, trying to shut down her giggles.
Look, Draco, Sirius said once they were well away from the house.
Draco was not stupid. He knew there was something going on. Everybody had been acting odd for the last few days, sharing glances and asking questions. He took a deep breath and prepared himself for the news. If they had decided that Sirius had to tell him, it was going to be bad.
It has been said, and I believe it is a gross exaggeration, but nevertheless, it has been said that we the Blacks have a certain tendency towards uncontrolled emotionality.
Who said that? What kind of vermin would say that? Draco was the master of temperance. He was restraint and control. He knew just how to keep a cool head at all times. He would show them.
I won't tell you the details, because I don't want to completely ruin the surprise, Sirius went on.
He had both hands on Draco's shoulders now. Oh, this was going to be bad.
But just so you know, I'm supposed to keep you out of the house for the morning, because they're preparing something to celebrate your birthday. I just thought you would like to know beforehand. Have a chance to compose yourself.
Draco didn't really hear the next words because his ears were ringing and his head felt faint, and he was embarrassed already and so deeply moved. Merlin, those idiots, they had adopted him without questions, welcomed him in their little nest, and now they were doing this. They remembered. Harry, he must have known and remembered, and took the time to prepare something, and his eyes had filled with tears.
Yeah,
Sirius said over him, both arms clutching him tightly and his chin resting on top of Draco's head.
This is exactly what I feared, and because they're fools, they wouldn't understand, and they would feel bad about it. Have I told you this?
James's parents passed away just a year after graduation. But still, when I was 16... Ah, you're turning 16 too. Anyway, when I was 16, they let me move in with them, and even offered to adopt me. And let me tell you, but I bawled when I heard. 15 minutes of tears and snot, I kid you not. It was horrible. One of the most embarrassing moments in my life. I cried so hard I was dehydrated.
You asked McGonagall out,
mumbled Draco from inside the embrace. Sirius's shirt was starting to get wet already. He could feel it against his cheek.
How's that not the top one?
Oh, it's definitely top 10, Sirius answered gently, patting Draco's head. And I can't tell you about the top one, because everyone involved has been sworn to secrecy. Pete's had an asthma attack, and Shacklebone, who was a prefect, I must say, and held to a high standard, laughed so hard that he pissed himself. And still no one held that against him.
Draco chuckled. In a few minutes he would be ready to step back. Sirius kept patting his head.
Medics are clueless, but potters are sneaky, aren't they? They have a way to dig their claws in your heart.
Despite Sirius's warning, Draco couldn't help getting emotional, although he did avoid the 20 minutes of ugly crying and simply got the much more dignified speechlessness and a bit of wet eyes. They had prepared a nice meal for the day, with roasted potatoes and melted cheese. Nothing compared to the feasts in Hogwarts or the delicacies from the manor, but to Draco it was delicious and wonderful anyway, and he could feel his stomach opening. And there was a cake, which explained why Harry had flour on his forehead and the frame of his glasses. Harry Potter had memorized cake recipes. He couldn't tell you what spell to use to light a candle, but he could make a cake from memory, and Draco had never in his life held higher hopes for the war that was coming. They sang him happy birthday. Despite being only three of them, they could not agree on the pitch or tempo. Sirius kept the last U for 30 seconds longer after everyone had finished. Remus elbowed him, because Sirius was not allowed to howl, only Remus was. Remus was teaching the boys all the important things. Practical ways to defend yourself from dark creatures, how to bypass some curses without a wand, and even some healing procedures. He also taught them how to budget and a few ways to access their accounts at Gringotts, because indeed the goblins did not snitch, ever, and they didn't care if an escaped criminal requested for some funds to be dropped at certain locations. They would want a signature, though. This was all part of the plan to protect them at all costs, make them self-sufficient in case Sirius or him went missing, make them promise that they would look after themselves and each other and don't take any risks. That had been an ugly evening when they had made them promise that. Sirius had to teach them about all the other important stuff. How to dress and how to shave, not much in that area yet, and how to charm people into giving you information. How to look like you meant business, so people would leave you alone if you ever had to hide in the less reputable places. How to find those places. How to look like someone else, so you wouldn't be remembered or recognized. Even if Harry had that part solved. And then, on a fateful day, Sirius decided they were old enough and that he ought to teach them how to seduce a girl. It was such a good class, too. He told them how to smile and how to look and how to find your style and colors that complimented you, and always be respectful of her, of course. You can't go around making promises you won't keep. Show her a good time. Remember to brush your tongue when you do your teeth. Use protection and be respectful. He would have died to have someone tell him all this at 16, rather than having to figure it out all by himself. This was life-saving intel, and yet the boys were looking at him quite disinterested. Sirius could not believe it.
Of course, this is also applicable to boys, he said tentatively. He shouldn't have assumed.
But still, no reaction. Draco spoke first. He was a pureblood. He would marry whoever his family thought adequate. He hadn't given much thought to it. What was the point when his future had already been decided? Why bother looking at someone when he knew it could never be? That seemed like setting up for heartbreak, and it was unnecessary. Besides, he had had many other things on his mind, like Quidditch and class conscience and systems of oppression. No time for romance at all.
Well, there must have been a girl you preferred, said Sirius.
Oh, well, I do like Pansy. She's very spirited. We were sort of together, but she doesn't like me that way.
Now, Draco, this is why you need to practice the smoldering look.
Pretty sure she prefers girls.
Ah,
Sirius looked down, dejected. Nothing to do, then. Harry didn't say anything, but he gave him a look. It was terrible. a look made of the wind on the top of a mountain, a look made of a moor with an unending horizon. Harry's look said, "To the place I'm going, I shouldn't drag anyone with me." He blinked and it was gone. Harry made a joke with James's voice. Draco answered. The banter filled the air and the sun shone. Sirius looked at Harry closely, but he seemed genuinely happy. He was not pretending. Harry had his t-shirt inside out and a blue sock on his left hand like a puppet. This was indicative of a burning question that had interrupted all other thought and dressing processes.
"I haven't seen you use your wand. How come you're not doing magic? We can do magic with adults around."
"I wasn't again."
"Oh, yeah, sorry." Harry waited patiently for Draco to spit the toothpaste. "So?" Draco didn't want to talk about it. If he said so, Harry would drop the topic. He was quite sure of it. He found himself speaking anyway. He had told Sirius and Remus, after all.
"That is such a great idea," exclaimed Harry. "I should have thought of it ages ago. Should have broken my wand."
"Please don't break your wand now. It's the only one we have. We may need it someday."
"Yes, but it's such a good idea."
Just in case, Draco followed Harry. Sirius and Remus had left to run some errands, pick up money and the post two towns away, so it obviously fell to Draco to make sure Harry didn't burn down the house or break his wand. Now, spending the morning in a melee football game in which gnomes, boys, and a poltergeist participated was a different thing, because the poltergeist hadn't tried murdering any of them in weeks, and the gnomes were not the tiny, bloodthirsty savages books described. They also went to the second floor and the room with no roof, and lay together looking at the sky and listening to Harry's music. The Walkman was seeing less use lately. Harry didn't have such a mad need to take shelter in music. Neither of them did.
Remus received a letter from Severus. He had good teacher's handwriting. The letter's clear despite the tiny size, so he could fit more information. "Glad." That was the first word in all the acknowledgement of the things Remus had told him. Severus could be ruthlessly practical, and he would not waste more space than necessary talking about his feelings. "A storm is coming," he went on. "One wants the prophecy. The professor and the politician want the child. The politician and the father want the other child. But he burned him from the family tree. Everybody is searching. Carry on as you are." The last words worried Remus the most. 15 years they had waited to see this. New DADA teacher, Snape. 15 years, and only 3 decent teachers in all that time, one of them a Death Eater in disguise. Remus worried. At last Dumbledore had accepted Severus's request, and Remus worried that Severus would have to be the one to prepare those poor students for what was coming. Severus would not waste time or space on his emotions, and for that he could seem cold and uncaring. However, Remus knew him to be a hopeless romantic with a sensitive soul. Remus unfolded the envelope with careful fingers, pressing down the creases of the paper. Inside, with the same careful handwriting, was a recipe for an ache relief potion, one that hardly required any magic ingredients to prepare. And if you turn the paper upside down, in between the lines with different ink, there was another recipe for the nausea associated with the moon. Harry baked his own birthday cake. It was agreed by everyone that one should not have to bake their own cake, but Harry, being chief baker, insisted on doing it because he would like to have something actually edible. Remus, perhaps Remus could do it given time and a very detailed recipe, although he never cooked twice the same thing. Always had to change it a little bit, and that is very risky in baking. Draco was too used to magic, but in a few weeks' time, with some more practice, he would stir by hand just as well as by wand. Sirius, if he somehow managed to get himself so lost as to set actual foot in the kitchen, should gently yet firmly be let outside immediately.
"You asked me to crack the eggs, and I'll crack the eggs," pointed out Sirius.
"You obliterated the eggs against the corner of the counter.
Oh, can't you just scoop them up?"
Sirius, who was a highly intelligent wizard with extensive knowledge of transfiguration and charms, hell, who had devised the adaptation of the tracking hominem revelio charm used in the Marauder's Map, Sirius in all his brilliant glory, was a potion menace the likes of which dwarfed even Longbottom's most disastrous lessons. Honestly, the mutual dislike with Snape seemed only natural.
"He only paused because of your mother," Remus said. "He would pilfer spoonfuls of her cauldron to add to his own."
I did not. That only happened twice, thrice at most.
Draco, who had ascended to chocolate melting duty, looked crestfallen at the revelation of his hero's shortcomings.
Nobody understands it, because Sirius is quite a powerful wizard otherwise, Remus went on. Have you told them about your bike?
He had not. He used to own a muggle bike, which he enchanted to fly like a broom. It significantly helped him to proclaim his status as the cool authoritative figure. Not then did it ever been in much danger because Moody insisted on them eating vegetables and keeping proper sleep hours for Merlin's sake. Sirius found a place in the counter, where he made himself comfortable and chattered merrily while they cooked and baked around him. It was actually very nice, the mingling aromas slowly rising and Sirius's voice accompanying their movements. It was, in fact, excellent, and Harry didn't need any other gift. And Draco got a gift, too, even if it was not his birthday.
And it's all lies. Because even if the last three potions teachers have been Slytherins, that means nothing. Not all Slytherins are good at it. And it could be in another house and be good, too. Look at Harry or Lily. But they said I was bad because I was in Gryffindor and a blood traitor, which, excuse me, but is a fuck serious,
Remus growled in a low warning tone.
Freaking load of hippogriff manure, because at least I never confused sparkly dust with fairy dust.
Condrick's girdle, who would do that? Draco exclaimed, laughing. He was hunched over, focused on the delicate task of shaping the cookie dough.
Not even Longbottom did that.
Harry frowned and bit his lower lip.
We were not in class that day. We stopped him just in time.
He was in charge of the last stages of cake baking, but he had generously released some dough and ingredients so they, and by they he meant Draco, could also make cookies. Remus had soon abandoned the task and was leaning against the wall opposite Sirius, offering corrections to the running commentary and occasionally reaching for something high or opening a jar.
And, Sirius went on, because 20 years was not enough time to forgive the affront, I never sneezed inside my cauldron.
You did, multiple times. In other people's cauldrons, too.
And I certainly never sneezed so hard that I dropped the candy I was eating in class inside the potion.
That is true, Remus conceded.
And if that had happened, which it didn't, but if it had, I believe I would have enough sense to quickly retrieve the candy, rather than let it melt inside and create whatever that was. I don't know, there were screams and something in the shape of a leopard running around, and they had to close the dungeons for 2 days.
Draco was shaking so hard with laughter he could not utter a sound. Harry had tears in his eyes.
And that was all a pure blood Slytherin, and I don't see anyone giving him grief for it,
Sirius finished.
Who?
Harry attempted to ask, or perhaps Draco. The boys were now leaning against each other so they wouldn't fall. So this is why jungleries were so strictly forbidden in Snape's class. Everybody thought it was to avoid accidental chokings when students swallowed them whole in terror.
Sirius, who did that?
Harry asked again.
Ah, well, for some reason now Sirius seemed doubtful. I thought this would be common knowledge.
Oh, dear no, Draco was wiping tears away, and in the process filling his face with cocoa powder.
It is not. Not even in the Slytherin common room. Right, right. How? Listen, Sirius interrupted. Most of this happened before I went to Hogwarts, and the last incident occurred while I was in my first year, so perhaps this had been slightly exaggerated.
It was not. It was not exaggerated in the least. Sirius just felt bad because it occurred to him that perhaps he shouldn't trash-talk like that one Lucius Abraxas Malfoy who, by the way, did not even attempt to take his Owl Level Potion class, so there would be no record of him failing ignominiously. Strawberries. It was high summer and they were living near a forest. Of course Draco and Harry had gone to pick wild strawberries. Harry still had the taste on his lips. Draco was sweating under his leather jacket, but he clung to it desperately, and there was no way to make him give it up. They were both smiling. They were returning to the house through the little back door in the garden fence. Not because they were hiding, but because of something as simple and innocent as the fact that it was closer. They didn't want to walk around the whole property to enter through the main door. An invisible force pushed them back.
Oof! What? Potter, remove yourself from my chest immediately!
Harry snorted and pushed himself up and then helped Draco back to his feet. They tried to enter again, and again they were rejected. This happened 2 more times.
Colin, is that you? Harry said, smiling. If he had decided to kick you out of the house for giving him such a pedestrian name, I won't be surprised.
Draco fixed his clothes and made a show of crossing the door after taking an imaginary hat from his head and bowing. Only he was immediately pushed back. For the first 2 minutes, they actually thought it was a fun joke, and they laughed about it.
But then Harry crouched to take a few pebbles to throw to the windows, and Draco started to call for Sirius or Remus to let them in, and then Colin, the resident spirit, suddenly wasn't so friendly anymore. Harry found himself pressed down to the ground. He heard a thud and caught a flash of silver out of the corner of his eye. Draco was on the floor, too, both unable to move and starting to sweat with fear as they felt that familiar presence sitting on their chests, a cold hand pressing down over their mouths. They could not move. They could not move. Harry had no idea of what was going on, only that Colin let Draco up first. Because Draco was his favorite. Colin played more with Harry, but he liked the way Draco talked to him so ceremoniously. Draco got up, and Harry heard him run to the corner of the fence. He stopped there. He did not run to the front door. He ran back. "Thank you, Mr. Holfrost," Draco said. Of course, if Harry was going to name him, Draco had to make sure to put his piece there, too, and he gave him a last name. "I got him. Thank you. Please, thank you. The bag." Harry had seen with relief as Draco's face appeared back before his eyes, but now he felt as if Colin's icy hands had sunk into his heart and stomach. He felt Colin moving back, just as Draco got him by the shoulders, still begging madly. "The bag with his things. The wand. Don't let them find anything. Please, please, save the wand. They'll know the wand." "Draco, we have to stay here." Draco's fingers were like talons on his arms. "I'm so sorry." The poltergeist went back to the house, apparently intent on conquering the title of most haunted house in known history. They could hear the shrieks from there, awful and high, just like the sound of death angered. There was broken glass and smashed furniture. A window opened, and Harry's bag squeezed through and came flying towards them. The window smashed shut, and what remained of the roof trembled. There was another scream, higher and louder and carrying more weight. The kitchen was on fire. He knew what it was. Harry was a very bad student, but he was not stupid. He knew, but he didn't want to know. He wanted someone to tell him he was wrong, as he so often was in class, that it was something else. "Come on," Draco was saying, helping him up and leading him back to the tree line. "We have to go, come on." There was a thunderous noise, loud, loud. So loud it muted Harry and whatever he might have said. He didn't know himself if he was crying or begging or cursing Draco or simply repeating the word no. The noise went up and took the roof with it, hovering 3 meters above the rest of the house and spinning over itself counterclockwise. All the smaller objects in the house were dragged up into the whirlpool. They were back in the trees now, hidden from view. Draco was trembling, shaking, but his arms were still around Harry, holding him fast. He may have been saying something too, pleading words lost in the whirl of noise and wind. The floating objects started to explode. First the little ones, pop, 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 pop. The spoons and the toothbrushes. Then the clothes caught on fire, and the flames engulfed everything else. As they went further back into the forest and a bit to the left to take the trail, they came to see another angle of the house. This is what Draco had seen. Harry saw a wizard desperately holding to a window frame, his gold-lined robes flapping up in the wind. Another was ineffectually trying to douse the flames, and a third one was legging it, running for the security offered by the other side of the fence, where two more of his workmates were cowering. It had been Harry's birthday, and they had been happy. And a few weeks later, they had come to take it all. Draco was counting his blessings. Blessing number one. Harry hadn't run back to the house and attempted to fight all the ministry wizards with a handful of pebbles. He didn't thrash against Draco's arms, not too much, and he didn't give away their location with his screams. Blessing number two, they had a wand. Blessing number three, it was not raining. Blessing number four, there was a remarkable lack of giant spiders on fire. This was as much as Draco could count. He was not counting his losses. He took them as far away as possible, a whole hour of march through the fields before he let them sit down and then lie on the ground and cry. Well, he cried. Harry did nothing. Harry was gone. He seems to have retreated into himself, and Draco would seriously worry about it, except that he couldn't, not now. All he could do was count his blessings, like the fact that he didn't have to work harder at pulling Harry back from the house. He found himself wishing Weasley were there. He would know how to snap Harry out of it without making him go into his wild, I-will-fight-everything mode. Draco was not counting his losses. He was not thinking about Sirius and Remus. He was not obsessing about the little details of the glimpses he had caught of the wizards, aurors, and special operators coming to the house. He was not going through the images again and again. The moon had been just 2 nights ago, and Remus had been tired. Draco wasn't thinking about that either. Draco, for all the dramatic flair of the Malfoys and the Black, could keep a level mind in a crisis. He had learned to see a situation through and push the crying and panicking for later. He cried now, a little bit, to get the edge off. He pushed everything down, the fear and hurt that was threatening to drown him. He pushed them down to his stomach where they often lived, and let his mind clear to think what they should do. Flee. Hide. They arrived in London with the night. That weird hour of gray light, not so dark to turn the lights on, but not so clear that you could see either. The hour when a jacket was just too much, but a shirt was too little. They stepped down from the night bus, and Draco thanked the driver profusely. Just as he didn't count his losses, he very carefully didn't think how he had learned to do this. How it occurred to him to pass his jacket, Sirius's jacket, to Harry and pushed his hair down to cover his scar, and to take Harry's glasses for himself. The kid was almost blind, by the way. How to give the image of two foreign students who had drank a bit too much and had a bit too much fun, and if they didn't return to their group instantly, they were going to be killed by the French equivalent of Minerva McGonagall. People looked at the accent and forgot everything else. "We have need to go to London," Draco had said, and the whole bus had cringed. They looked and they saw two foreign young boys being disgustingly foreign and irresponsible. They didn't see. He had paid for the tickets with a check. 22 sickles to be taken from Gringotts Vault number 711. Draco made the signature just as Remus had taught him. The bus left immediately, vanishing without a second thought for the two teenagers it left behind. Still, Draco had not given their final destination, just in case someone read the prophet later and got ideas. They were just 2 or 3 streets away from the house that had popped in Draco's mind that he knew would be uninhabited and reasonably safe. Thankfully, Harry seemed to start waking up from his shock and was able to quietly direct them, because Draco was confused with the street layout. He knew Diagon Alley and he knew other wizarding districts, but he wasn't used to so many streets and houses and walking. Rich people never walk except on beautiful designated spaces. You walked down the pretty part of Diagon Alley to let yourself be seen, but you didn't walk into Burrington's, inconveniently located outside Diagon Alley in somewhere called Savile Road. You flew or apparated there. They arrived at the street just as the gray light turned into shadows. The lampposts were just turning on, and Draco had to take a deep breath and squeeze Harry's hand. He had no idea when they had started to hold hands, but he was not letting go. It looked horrible. The light was horrible, the street was horrible, and the house was horrible. And he would give all the gold in the Malfoy vault if he could just go back to their haunted house. They came to the gate. There was a short path of paved stone and 3 steps to the door. There were also 50 silent breaths, and the night coming, and holding hands for comfort, and the impossibility to move and take a step forward. "Let's go through the back," said Harry. Those were his first words in hours. They walked together all the way to the end of the street and around to the back of the line of houses. The rear of the buildings had plain brickwork with no adornments. No one important was supposed to come to the houses this way. The backyard for number 12 had an old wood fence, tall enough to keep eyes away, but not so tall that they couldn't jump over it and come to a grim, sad patio with overgrown poisonous plants and a derelict shack where they probably kept the gardening tools and the brooms. A tendril of devil's snare crept towards them, but they were both so crestfallen it quickly retreated back. There was a door with flaking white paint. The typical door in between stairs, down to the kitchens or up to the living and dining rooms. Draco had no idea how they were going to open it. If it was locked, they could use a Lohomora, only that would call the Ministry wizards, and Harry may have been able to fool them before, but right now, the most he could do was depress them, if he reacted at all.
He was thinking that they could find something in the shant, or even spend the night there if need be. But it didn't matter, because the door seemed to recognize him. There was a wave of warmth extending from the doorknob to the rest of the frame, and the door opened under Draco's hand. They stood there in the backstairs landing, silent and unmoving for close to 10 minutes. Nobody had to know this. Perhaps they held hands the whole time. The house was silent and unused and dead. These are all passive traits, yet it managed to make them active, like it was forcing its silence and death on you. It was a sensation similar to stepping below a bridge, the sudden absence of light and that pungent smell of rot and old mud. There was a house elf. He may have come as soon as they opened the door, or he may have just appeared. It wasn't important. They had only just noticed him. "I," said Draco with confidence, "am Draco Malfoy, son of Narcissa Black, godson of Regulus Black, and this," he lifted the hand that was still holding Harry's, "is Harry Potter, godson of Sirius Black, last living male member of the main branch. And by our shared entitlement and inheritance, by the bloodline, and by the sacred line of guardianship, we claim this, the house of the Black family, as ours." The elf did not seem very happy about this, but he was a house elf, and he would obey. Draco's claim speech had been good. Perhaps not so good that a lawyer couldn't pick it apart, but good enough that the house would have to accept them. It had let them in the first place. Besides, there were not many competitors that could claim the house, and they certainly weren't there right now. They went downstairs to the kitchen to further horrify the house elf, who was sure no proper Black had ever set foot in the kitchen in 100 years. He was lying. Sirius and Regulus used to come down and help themselves to food all the time. The elf actually whimpered when he saw Draco opening a cabinet. "Enough of this," Draco said in a mimicry of his father's most commanding tone. "You will not tell nor facilitate the knowledge of our presence here to anyone. Now you will go, in silence, and cover every portrait in the house." "And every mirror," he added as the elf started to move. You just couldn't trust mirrors. Anything could come crawling out of them. It was a good precaution, but thinking of it seemed to take what little energy he had left. He collapsed on a chair, drained of everything. Now Draco could cry and flail as much as he wanted to. But he was so tired no tears would come. When they took him and me, the last time. It was night. They were both sitting on the floor with the remains of their dinner between them. There was a perfectly serviceable table with chairs right there in the kitchen, but somehow it had felt more adequate to sit on the old stone floor, sides pressed together. They had eaten in silence, like animals, eating because it is an imperative. You need food to survive, but with no thought spared for the taste, no thought spared for anything. But now Harry spoke. Now he felt himself with enough strength to speak, with the need to speak. He had to fill the silence and the space between him and Draco. "I'd done a bit of magic before, you know. Mostly around the house. It was warded, the house. And they came at night, in the full moon. And I fought them. And I remember that they apparated me to someone and I set the room on fire. I don't know why I'm telling you this. I've never told anyone. The paper and the fabric and the chairs and the curtains and the robes of the wizards, everything. I set on fire everything." He remembered being surprised and frightened and not knowing how he had done it or why he wasn't burning. He was afraid of not being able to control it, but at the same time he didn't want it to stop. "And then, I don't know, they cast Petrificus Totalis or something and they sent me to sleep, and the next day they gave me a talk and took me to the Dursleys. It was like a religious ritual, a whole different kind of magic, one with words weaved in a half-lit kitchen. A magic that was profound and terrible and cleansing. I couldn't do any magic after that. I know everybody knows I'm almost a squib most of the time, but those months until Christmas, I could do nothing. Ron used to share his work with me, you know. Remember when McGonagall had us turning matches into needles?
He would do half of one for me, then another for himself, so it would look like I'd done something. There was relief, both in saying and listening to those words. Draco was next. He opened his mouth, and the words came pouring. The summer after the adoption hearing. Words he hadn't shared with anyone. Severus had known, somehow, and spared him the necessity of voicing them. Sirius and Remus had guessed enough through the image Draco had painted for them. But this was the first time he had told anyone of the beating, and not just the beating, because that was merely physical pain, and he could suffer it. But the more profound hurt of his father inflicting pain on him. Harry told him about the cupboard under the stairs, about how it wasn't that bad in itself, but it had brought some memories, a feeling of being so small and alone and weak he didn't want to experience ever again. How that first week with the Dursleys all he wanted was for the earth to swallow him alive. Draco spoke of avoiding his father, of being the perfect son mostly by being absent, of the fear and of how, after that terrible time, hitting him became his father's answer for everything, every transgression. They talked and talked until they realized they were thirsty and tired and starting to get cold, sitting there on the kitchen floor. It was a horrible day and a horrible night, and they both felt hurting and raw. But it was healing in a way. "We should go find a room to sleep," said Draco. "We'll have to be quiet so the portraits don't hear us." The house was big and rich despite its current derelict status, 4 floors plus the kitchen and the basement. It had everything to make it better than most city houses, and yet it felt less welcoming than the actual haunted house with half a roof in which they had spent the summer. There was a copy of The Prophet in the library. To Draco's surprise, it was a recent one. But then again, no surprise at all. A good house would have a standing subscription, one that no one had bothered to cancel after the death of the matriarch. The elf would bring the paper in, and after a day he would exchange it for the new one, a pointless ritual repeated through the years because that was how pure-blood families were. There was today's special edition, announcing the double arrest of Britain's most feared fugitives, Remus Lupin and Sirius Black. As if the Lestranges hadn't escaped in January. Draco couldn't understand how the paper didn't self-combust in embarrassment at the blatant lies printed there. He couldn't believe Fudge's smug expression under the headline, "Black and Lupin Captured, Minister Brings Safety." Still, Draco stood there, reading every line of the stupid news that claimed there had been a deep and thorough ministerial investigation, when the arrest was most likely due to chance or someone snitching. There was no mention of Harry's presence. They hadn't known to look for 1 or 2 teenagers. Draco had a thought, an ugly adult Slytherin thought, that Sirius and Remus maybe had let themselves be arrested, if it meant keeping the wizards away from the house and the boys. There was nothing else of use in the paper, and yet Draco read it all again, standing unmoving in the middle of the library. And so he was still there when Creature came with the evening special edition on a silver tray. They really had to keep their presence a secret. Merlin knew how many of these paintings had pictures in other houses or in Hogwarts. What they could hear and what they could say, and to whom. Draco didn't want to find out what would happen if someone heard rumors of sudden movement in the ancestral Black House. Draco left the library, the evening paper clutched in his hands.
"Harry!"
he whispered frantically.
End of chapter 1. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.